Hello, welcome to The Wire, where fresh coverage of independent news and current affairs from right around Australia comes to you on your local community radio station. I'm Roderick Chambers in Sydney, and coming up on the program today...
There have been substantial impacts to hard coral cover across the Great Barrier Reef, and this is due largely to the impacts of the 2024 mass coral bleaching event.
Last year's marine heatwave has affected the Great Barrier Reef, and the coral cover is declining. There are fears that some areas of the barrier reef may never recover. Also on the program...
Like for a small community that lives off the resources in nature, those communities, they get affected a lot when those resources change. So they are very fragile.
A new film based in the remoteness of the Faroe Islands explores the difficulties economic and environmental pressures are placing on the traditional way of life. Stephen Hill speaks with the film's director, coming up on The Wire. But first... The Australian Defence Force has seen the biggest increase in recruitment in over 15 years, following a sustained pattern of decline. 24-25, the ADF enlisted more than 7,000 new personnel, the highest annual intake since 2010. This represents a 17% increase over last year. Maeve Groom asked Professor Robert Hoffman from the Tasmanian Behavioural Lab at the University of Tasmania what he thinks is driving this surge in recruitment.
Yeah, the first thing we should say is that this came as a considerable shock to most of us after we faced a period of severe shortages. So suddenly we get this really great news. The problem in identifying the drivers is that several things have changed at the same time. So it's a little bit difficult to tell exactly what it was. To the best of my analysis, it's probably what the ADF have done themselves in terms of advertising and promoting service has probably done the trick.
And in terms of this advertising and promoting services, it's been attributed to targeted advertising on platforms such as TikTok and online gaming. Do you think this is the best way to appeal to Gen Z in particular of what a career in the Defence Force entails?
Yes, it makes sense. And it does tally with what professionals have been discussing in this space. Gen Z people are digital natives. TikTok, I'm probably a little bit too old to talk about this, but things like TikTok appear to be where they are. And to embed the messages in those media that these people are used to is probably the right way to go.
So why was recruitment initially lagging for such a long time? And what made Australians reluctant to consider enlisting in the ADF?
I mean, I think the reason why recruitment has been a problem in most Western volunteer forces. And the reason could be potentially changing values of the population. I think as generations change, values like patriotism, nationalism, duty and service have probably changed. What we do know with Generation Z specifically is that they are very interested in personal motivations, making a difference, looking for meaning. And these things do not always obviously tally with service in the defense forces. And the other reason, of course, is to some people, service and defense forces might be associated with mental and physical hardship, with fighting. And of course, in the modern army, that's no longer necessarily the case. There's a lot of humanitarian missions, peacekeeping and similar things. And I think once they're properly advertised, service will become much more attractive.
What has the ADF done in particular to market the Defence Force as a career prospect for young people in particular?
I'm not really an expert at all the ins and outs of how exactly they advertise. I can only give you a general flavour from what I've seen, not just in the ADF, but also in other countries like Germany. They're just basically trying to appeal in the advertising to the kind of non-combat things you might get out of a military career. For instance, one example would be you get trained in using modern technologies, the camaraderie and comradeship, but also, of course, making a positive difference. If you are on a humanitarian mission abroad, you are making a positive difference, and that appeals. And I think those aspects of service have been highlighted correctly, to my mind.
Do you believe some Australians may be primarily driven to enlist based on their own political views on the current climate of the world and the various conflicts going on?
Yeah, we do know from other countries and from Australia that service is associated with certain kinds of views and demographics, certain political views, certain views of country and so on and so forth. But that's probably not the driver here for the uptick that we've seen in Australia, because those views don't change overnight. And the uptick is from one year to the next. So they will probably have an impact slowly and over the years, but it's certainly not enough to explain what we've seen in the news in the last few days.
Do you believe this surge could represent a renewed nationalist or patriotic movement within Australia, akin to what we see in countries like the US?
I know that in the US, some commentators have basically argued that increased patriotism is behind the increased numbers that they are seeing. My experience is slightly different. As I'm speaking as a European here and born in Germany, although I'm Australian, the war in Ukraine is very, very personal for many Europeans, especially in Central Europe. And we have seen a similar uptake in the German armed forces. But interviews have revealed that the Ukraine war, no matter how personal it is to people, was not the main driver behind it. So I don't think international conflict or patriotic or similar motivations are explaining what we're seeing. I don't think they're probably a reliable way to increase recruitment in the long term. I think the focus on what makes Gen Z tick and what service can offer to them is a much better way to go.
Is there anything that the ADF could do to keep this surge in recruitment to encourage people to continue to enlist?
I think what I would have to say as a scientist is they've done so many things at the same time, all good things, that it's very, very hard to tell which did the work here. And we would need much more analysis, much more research to find out. That kind of research, of course, is advertising research. So as an economist, I wouldn't like to comment too much on that.
Professor Robert Hoffman from the Tasmanian Behavioural Lab at the University of Tasmania, speaking there with Maeve Groom. Japanese company Mitsubishi Heavy Industries has secured the $10 billion contract to construct a new fleet of warships for the Australian Navy, beating out German company ThyssenKrupp Marine Systems. The 11 Megumi frigates are expected to be ready by the end of the decade. First three vessels will be built in Japan, whilst the remaining eight are set to be constructed in Western Australia. James Bale asked Adam Lockyer, Associate Professor in Strategic Studies at Macquarie University, why Australia went with the Mitsubishi Heavy Industries bid.
The Japanese ship is more capable. It's more automated, it has more firepower, and it has a smaller crew, which is really important in Australia's case because we've always struggled to crew our warships. However, there's an additional benefit of going with the Japanese bid, being that this will align Australia more closely with Japan through not just the manufacture, but also the upkeep and also interoperability. So our ships can work more closely together.
How has Australia's relationship with Japan since World War II evolved leading up to the steel?
Oh, it's transformed. So during World War II, they were our greatest threat. We were at war with Japan. After the Second World War, when the United States occupied and the Australians occupied Japan for a while, things began to slowly improve. So it took a long time. During the 1950s, when Australia signed up to the ANZUS Treaty, it still had a bit of an eye towards the future threat coming from Japan. So when the United States allowed Japan to rearm, Australia was quite concerned about the rearmament of Japan in the 1950s. So we're working more closely with Japan and other nations in the region as we're trying to stabilise the effects of growingly powerful China.
Adding on to that, will a fresh fleet of warships change the way military powers such as China conduct exercises in the Pacific region?
Our ships aren't going to change the way that China's behaving, but what it will do is allow us to do more. So Australia is an island nation. The vast majority of our goods come from sea. And so if you were trying to apply military force on Australia, one of the first things that you would try and do is block our maritime trade. And so what these frigates tend to do is to patrol the world's oceans and to try to stabilize those trade routes and secure those trade routes so they're going to be more difficult to interfere with.
Adding on to the idea of trade routes, will the warships reaffirm Australia's position as a security partner to the likes of New Zealand and the US?
Yeah, so the United States was also favouring the Japanese bid over the German bid. The reason for that was that the United States would like to see its partners in the Indo-Pacific working more closely together with one another. So not just, you know, Japan working with the United States and Australia working with the United States. The United States would like to see Australia and Japan, as well as others, working more closely with each other. It will help those type of hub and spoke relationships. But then the New Zealand side of things, there is sort of talk that the New Zealanders are going to have to recapitalise their frigates as well, because they're currently operating the Anzac-class frigates as well, which is the ones that we're going to be replacing with these new Japanese ships. And so what the New Zealanders do from this stage is yet to be seen, but it might well be that they might be favouring ships from the Indo-Pacific rather than traditionally from Europe, so Spain or the German ships.
In regard to Australia's defence needs and defence budget, how viable is this deal with Mitsubishi Heavy Industries in terms of costs and time frame to get this fleet up and running?
Yeah, in terms of cost, they were the more expensive bid, but in terms of overall cost, this sort of pales in comparison to other budgetary pressures on defence like the Orca submarines. So $10 billion is a lot of money, but in defence terms, it's not sort of eye-watering money. The delivery is a different question. So one of the biggest question marks over the Japanese bid was the Japanese ability to build ships overseas. So we know the Japanese are very good at building ships in Japan. They've got a long track record of delivering ships on time and on budget. However, they've never built ships overseas before. And part of what Australia acquired was the first three ships to be built overseas. So in this case, it will be in Japan. Or if the Germans had one, the first three ships would be built in Germany. But then the remaining eight ships were going to be built in Adelaide. And the Germans have a long history of being able to build ship overseas in Australia, whereas the Japanese have never done this before. And so that's the big question mark over the Japanese bid.
While the contract is still being finalised, what should Richard Mao's and the Australian government take into consideration during negotiation?
Yeah, I think the biggest sticking point now are going to be, well, these first three ships are going to be built in Japan. One of the promises of Japan was that Australia would even get one of the ships that was intended to be built for Japan. So they're going to let Australia push in line of even their own Navy in order to get these ships on time. Now, that's a great thing for us, but whether or not these are going to be able to be incorporated into Australia's fleet effectively is going to be the big question. Even though we're trying to get these ships as close to off the shelf as possible, some changes are going to be needed, and whether or not we're going to be able to get those necessary changes into the current hulls are going to be the big question.
Associate Professor Adam Lockyer from the School of International Studies at Macquarie University, speaking there with James Bale. A survey conducted by the Australian Institute of Marine Science has found that the coral cover in the Great Barrier Reef is in decline. This has been happening since the summer of 2024, when a record-breaking marine heat wave rocked the Barrier Reef, causing a major bleaching event. Because of the severity of this event, there are fears that the Barrier Reef may not recover very well. Thomas Kutis asked Dr. Mike Emsley, a research team leader in long-term monitoring at the Australian Institute of Marine Science, what were the main findings in the survey?
What we found this year as part of the long-term monitoring program at the Australian Institute of Marine Science is that there have been substantial impacts to hard coral cover across the Great Barrier Reef. And this is due largely to the impacts of the 2024 mass coral bleaching event, which unfolded through January 2024, but also partially from two tropical cyclones and continuing outbreaks of crown of thorns starfish.
And how did the 2024 marine heatwave impact coral bleaching and the mortality across different regions of the reef?
The marine heatwave in 2024 is actually part of the fourth global mass coral bleaching event, which started in the Northern Hemisphere in their summer in 2023, so mid-year, June, July, August, progressively made its way to the Great Barrier Reef and resulted in extensive coral bleaching across the whole of the Great Barrier Reef, so right from Cape York all the way down through to the southern end of the Great Barrier Reef off Gladstone. And at the time, we knew it was the most severe in terms of the accumulated heat stress that had impacted the Great Barrier Reef. But now that we've completed our surveys for the 2025 season, what we're able to say is it's also one of the worst impacts in terms of the loss of living coral on the Great Barrier Reef. So the northern region has lost about a quarter of the coral that was there prior to the mass coral bleaching event. The southern Great Barrier Reef has fared slightly worse, and it's lost about a third of the coral cover that we recorded prior to the event. And the central barrier reef has got off somewhat lightly and lost about 14% of the levels of coral that were there before the bleaching event.
Why are the fast-growing coral species both a sign of recovery and a source of concern for long-term reef health?
Well, those corals, and they're called Acropora, as you said, are really fast-growing, and they're pretty much the most dominant group of corals on the Great Barrier Reef, and they're responsible for a large portion of the dynamics that we see in the total hard coral cover. So the total hard coral cover is a metric we use to indicate how much of the reef surface is covered in living coral, and that's made up of all different types of coral. So Acropora are a really important group of corals. They grow really fast, they colonise really quickly, but the downside of it is that they're also really susceptible to heat stress and to coral bleaching. They're the preferred prey of crown of thorn starfish outbreaks, and they're really susceptible to breakage by waves generated by storms and cyclones.
What does the recent decline in coral cover suggest about the resilience of the Great Barrier Reef to climate change?
Oh, it absolutely points to the fact that the Great Barrier Reef is under continued and cumulative stresses. It's showing that these bleaching events are now occurring more frequently. They were pretty much unheard of at this scale prior to the 1990s, and we're now seeing them occurring with an increasing frequency. Just since I've started researching on the reef in the 90s, we've had an event in 98, in 2002, then a bit of a break to 2016, and 2017 was the first back-to-back event. In 2020, 2022, 2024, and now again in 2025 for the second back-to-back event.
And how might the continuation of global warming affect the reef's ability to recover from future bleaching events?
The key to recovery for coral reefs is that they have enough time between successive disturbance events. As I just highlighted for you, these events are now coming more quickly. And the projections under climate change moving forward is that trend is only going to continue and likely to increase until coral bleaching, and we're looking at an annual event. So really, there'll be no time left for corals to recover.
So what actions are scientists and policymakers recommending to protect the reef from further degradation?
Well, I can't comment on government policy, but certainly one recommendation is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Absolutely, that's the number one danger to reefs globally and to the Great Barrier Reef. So we need to be doing everything we can in our power to reduce those to levels where we keep the temperature increases as close to 1.5 as we can. Other things that can be done and are being done currently are local management actions. So the Great Barrier Reef does have a COTS control program, so that's crown of thorn starfish control program, which teams of divers go out onto the reef. And then the final strategy we can try and implement is to research into adaptation and restoration, just to try and give reefs a bit of a breathing space until we bring those emissions under control.
Mike Emsley, a research team leader in long-term monitoring at the Australian Institute of Marine Science, speaking there with Thomas Cooters. A new film set in the Faroe Islands explores the struggle to maintain a traditional connection with land and culture in an environment where economic conditions are driving people to leave for the mainland in Denmark. In The Last Paradise on Earth, we encounter Kari, who is left with difficult choices, finding a new job after the fish factory collapses, whilst also caring for his sister. Stephen Hill asked the film's director, Sakaris Stora, what was the inspiration for the film?
I think the idea came from my time on a factory, because I worked for 3 years on a fish factory like the one in the film. And I did that instead of going to college. So I did that like full-time for 3 years, and I wanted to show the culture and the environment that is like in on the factory and around the factory. And I live in a town that is similar to the one in the film, which has been like in a decline for like many years. But still there are people who like to live here, and I live here myself. So like based on the personal experience living that life.
So for many people, the Faroe Islands is not that well known. It's because of very small population across remote islands, and much of its income relies upon fishing and tourism, both of which are sporadic in their need for labour. Your film focuses on how difficult it is finding a sustainable living in such situations. Can you tell us a little bit about the social challenges of the people living in the Faroe Islands?
Yeah, like it depends, of course, if it's in the capital and the mainland, or if it's like more in the outskirts, like this film. Of course, it has like the challenges that every small place has. Like people want to follow their ambitions and move to the bigger world and experience things. But there are also those who want to stay, and the film is more focused about that. But it is happening in a time world where the world is changing a lot. There's like, of course, the environmental pressure, but there's also like this social pressure of everyone having to become something or be something, do something. So I think that this film is more about those who don't have those ambitions necessarily, and through hardship manage to see the beauty and the things that they have around them, even if things aren't that beautiful all the time.
So what's interesting is many of his Kauri's friends and colleagues are seeking opportunities for work and study outside the Faroe Islands, but at the same time, Kauri wants to remain connected to place and to culture, to environment. We see him, you know, many occasions, you know, he's just staring out in the fjords. Can you tell us a little bit about Kauri, how you developed this character?
I think I wanted to work with this character who sees the beauty in the things that he has around them, even if they aren't that beautiful all the time. I think one of the challenges was that he is like a very passive person in a way. He just flows along with everything. And then when this external threat hits him, then everything changes and everything falls on the floor. And I think also he's one of these masculine characters that doesn't say much. And I think it was funny to like explore that on like an emotional level. And at the same time, I think I can see a lot of myself and other people in that character. So I think that was the driving force behind writing that character.
And you also, at the same time, you've got the challenge of the absent father, also in that responsibility is foisted upon Kauri at a very young age due to his father working on a fishing boat. And this leads to him to having to become a surrogate father for his sister, who we discover later in the film is not attending school and is sort of similarly finding difficulty navigating into adulthood. Can you tell us a little bit about this relationship Kauri has with his sister?
It is non-existing relationship almost. I'm like, they just exist in the same house. And that is also because both of them are dealing with this grief and these emotions that they don't talk about and they don't listen to each other. So their relationship and their journey is to kind of acknowledge each other and listen to each other so they can like fight the challenges that they meet together.
It must have been quite a challenge getting this performance because as you said, Kauri's the performance from us, it's the main actor, Samuel Hansen. Kauri, he's a man of few words. So it's like, how were you able to show to an audience, you know, what was really going on in Kauri's mind?
Yeah, he's really good to work with. And I really enjoyed like working with the actors in this film. I think his character is very difficult to portray, a character who doesn't speak his mind. He doesn't say much. And his emotions, they have to like live on the outside of him without him showing them too much. We worked a lot with the script. It took a lot of time to do the script because we were like working in like three different languages on the script. So everything was like a lot of translations and stuff like that. But I also like kind of rehearsed a lot with them, especially the sister and the brother. And throughout that process, we also took their improvisations and what they added to the characters. And we took it back to the script and kind of mixed it around there. And then back to rehearsals. So it was a very organic process and a very living process in a way that helped create those emotions that you see and feel in the film.
So much of the conflict in the film is based around the collapse of the fishing industry on the islands. Has global warming impacted on the way in which this traditional practice is carried out?
Yeah, like for a small community that lives off the resources in nature, those communities, they get affected a lot when those resources change. So they are very fragile to the changes that are happening in the
nature. Stephen Hill speaking there with Sakara Stora, director of the film The Last Paradise on Earth. This is premiering at the Scandinavian Film Festival in all capital cities, as well as Canberra, Ballarat and Byron Bay. And that's it for The Wire today. You can find all of our stories online at thewire.org.au or subscribe to our podcasts. Just look for The Wire Radio. Today's program came from the studios of Radio 2 SER 107.3 here in Sydney and broadcast around the nation on the Community Radio Network. In Sydney, The Wire is produced on Gadigal country of the Eora Nation and with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. We're going to be back again tomorrow, so do tune in again then. I'm Roderick Chambers. Do stay well and thanks for your company.